fly in, fly out. We've all heard of it. We've all known someone who goes out to site, maybe a mine site or somewhere that's really remote, might stay there for the week, come back. And what can happen in these types of roles? The money's really good. There is a sacrifice. You're away from home. You might be isolated. You might have a really big week. But the question is, with this FIFO stuff, is it a forever thing? Or do we do a smash and grab and try and make some good money while we can and then look at what we're going to do after that? We're going to talk about that. And we're also going to touch on some interesting things about compounding negative returns, because we hear about compounding returns and compounding interest. It is awesome, but it can work the other way, my friends. Anyway, I want to thank Sphere Home Loans for supporting the episode today. When you get a mortgage, did you know there's a huge difference in lending capacity across different lenders? Yeah, that's right. You could go to one lender today and they would say, hey, here's some money for your home loan. Go to the one next door and they'd be like, hey, based on our policy, we'll give you more or less. So it's really important that you actually go to a broker that can have a look at your situation, who knows the lending climate and can get an offering from a lender that suits you. Just search Sphere Home Loans or click the link in the show notes and they'll be happy to help wherever you are in Australia. Remember, you don't need a mortgage broker where you live or where you're buying. Everything is online these days. Believe it or not, the internet has been around for about 25 years. Well, my name's Glenn James, joined by
Jessica Brady
from
Financially Fierce.
Oh, that sounds like a good podcast. And this is Money.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Rightio, this was an interesting question in the Facebook group, This Is Money. Liz said, does anyone know if there is a calculator that shows bad compounding interest? My husband, who is normally very smart with money, thinks that refinancing our home loan and getting a new car with the money is okay to pay it off over 30 years. We have plenty of equity in the home, but my concern is that what happens in 8 years' time when the car needs to be upgraded again and he wants to do the same thing again and again and again and again and again and again. I added all the agains, but she did a couple anyway. Is there a calculator out there that can show results of a decision like this? What do you reckon?
I find it interesting that she says that her husband is typically quite good with money but can't see that this, as she's rightly pointed out, this has no end date, because if it's an upgrade every 8 years or whatever, we're just rinsing and repeating the problem. I have quite a few thoughts on this. In terms of calculators, I say it a lot, but I really like the ASIC Money Smart calculator suite. And what they can help you do is put in your current mortgage and see, based on your current repayment and how many years you've got, what the total amount is that you're going to pay. And then you can change the number to include refinancing and resetting the 30 years, and you'll be able to see the difference. And what'll probably scare you is just to see the increase. Obviously, Glenn, when we work in financial advice land, we get all this pretty sophisticated modeling that I don't think you need to be able to argue the point. I think that that's a really good way to be able to actually step back and see from a helicopter perspective, like something that might seem really normal in inverted commas, which is upgrading the car, has a pretty considerable impact. A, not only because you're borrowing, and probably by the time your 8 years has come around, you may not have even paid off what you did and then you're doing it again. But B, the resetting of the 30 years, I think, needs to be taken into consideration as well. But I know you're wanting to talk about negative returns off the back of this, and I think this is a conversation that doesn't get enough airtime in general. But what's your thoughts?
Well, I think what I'm doing, I'm just doing this in real time.
Ooh, I wondered what you're doing.
Okay, so the Money Smart personal loan calculator, I'm just assuming $40,000 for a car, because I don't think she said how much the car was, and we're doing monthly repayments. Now, if we did this $40,000 personal loan, over 15 years, okay? And I've just done 6.5%, which is effectively a mortgage interest rate.
And
okay?
Why did you do 15 when she says 8 years? Did you go rogue there?
Oh, well, no, she said he wants to do it again in 8 years, but he thinks to pay it off over 30 years.
Mm, okay.
My loan is getting a new car, and that's okay to pay it off over 30 years. So that's his vibe.
Which is the mortgage time
frame. The maximum we can do in the calculator is 15 years.
Okay, now I get what you're doing.
Now, the amount of interest, let's have a look, is $22,000. So, over the 15 years, the principal that gets paid off is $40,000 mm-hmm. because, you know, that's part
payback,
of it.
Yeah.
But the interest is $22,000.
So, you paid over 60 in total.
That's right, for a $30,000 car. Now, if old mate wants to push that out over 30.
A $40,000 car, yes.
Yes. Over 30 years, the interest would be $44,000.
So you've doubled the car cost.
Yes.
And you're years further down the line in terms of being able to be mortgage free, which for a lot of people is their goal.
That's right. Now, if I go back and do it over 4 years, right, the interest is only $5,000. Mm. Now, it's a higher monthly repayment because we're paying down the principal sooner. Mm. But this whole thing about, and it, far out, there's so many discussions here because when buying a car, there's basically three big considerations. What type of car you want to buy, how are you going to fund it, and just understanding the depreciation, right? Mm-hmm. So everything that we buy, like a car, will have a depreciation. Like everything depreciates unless it's an asset that's producing revenue, right?
Yeah.
So my comments are, I think for old mate, he's more emotionally attached to getting a car and thinking it's cheap because we've got equity and we can do all that. Where I tell people, if we look at the funding decision, because philosophically, if you've got a mortgage, okay, and I've got a mortgage and I owe debt, right? Mm. This long black here, what was it, $4? Mm. Theoretically, I've borrowed $4 to pay for this coffee because I've got debt and I could have paid $4 for this coffee off my debt. Mm-hmm. So physically, emotionally, spiritually, all that, all the alleys, every time we consume and we've got debt, we're borrowing that money. Now, we've got to live our life, and I get that. But it really is interesting when you start to look at these amounts that are real money.
And I think because house prices have gone up so astronomically over the last few years, people have seen considerable equity growth in their property. It distorts their sort of understanding of what the reality day-to-day, you know, cash flow practicality-wise looks like because they're like, oh, well, you know, we've just made X amount of dollars over the last few years just by holding the asset. We be rich, thank you. And it's like, yeah, but you're talking about something, as you say, that depreciates over time that is likely you're going to need to upgrade again and again. This is not a one-and-done thing. Presumably you need a car for a while. And if your quest or goal is to get mortgage free, you're actually doing something that strategically it's defying the whole goal that you have. And I think people, particularly those that have owned a property for a long time and do have good equity, they kind of lose sight of that a bit. Look, I have very strong thoughts on cars, which is like, get the one that's the safest that, you know, is going to be the least expensive. No one gives a crap.
Just an update. How's the Peugeot?
Fine.
Yes. Okay, good.
She's fine.
Love it.
I bought a $2,000 Peugeot on a bit of a whim, to be honest. Glenn told me it was an absolute diabolical decision because any maintenance would be.
Yeah, but look, to prosecute my case, I think, remember, I came around to understanding that it was very low Ks respectively. And if it doesn't make it past rego, you'll just get rid of it.
Totally. So like talk to me in July when rego's due.
I will.
And we'll go more.
Okay. So if I can just swing back to.
Please do.
I actually got a better calculator up. I said over the 30 years, 40 grand, 44 grand. It's actually $38,000.
Are you looking interest. At the ASIC home loan?
Well, I'm looking at a home loan calculator now.
Yeah. That's fine. What are
you saying? The minimum or the monthly repayments, and this is kind of what I was really after, the monthly repayment over 30 years to do that is $190. Where it's like $190 a month to be driving a brand new $30,000 car. Let's go, baby. Mm. But now if we move that to loan term to 4 years, that's $700 a month. Mm. So
like $200 a month for 30 years.
Yep.
That's a long time.
That's
a lot of money.
And that's where it comes back to. when you are looking at the funding decisions.
Mm.
And I touched about this the other week when I had Rebecca Pritchard on the show, that in theory, it does work better to, if you're borrowing for the car. Okay, so number one, if you got debt.
Yeah.
And this is the psychology minefield, right? If you got debt, buying this coffee, $4, I'm borrowing. If I've got debt and I've got 30 grand cash and I pay for a car with 30 grand cash.
You've now changed the car to be worth 30,000, which is confusing. No, you said 40 in the beginning, but sure.
No.
Oh.
No, the interest. Hang on, did I?
Just so we're all playing along at home comprehensively. Fine, a $30,000 car or a $40,000 car, it doesn't matter, but just so we're all understanding.
Okay, my bad. 30 years, $51,000 interest. Are you sure?
No, now you've made me question. Are you gaslighting me? What are you doing to me?
Jess and I have these things like one of us are crazy. We've had two interactions
and
this week.
It's both been me.
No, but
so this could be my
okay,
third.
Either way, we'll assume $30,000 car for. So if I had a mortgage and I had $30,000 cash,
yeah.
right, and bought the car with cash,
mm.
done. In theory, it makes more financial sense to get a car loan and cash flow that and invest the $30,000 or pay the $30,000 down on the home. So when you look at it that way, in theory, it works better to cash flow it that way and get a car loan over 4 years.
Yes. There's an interest rate conversation here though, surely.
Yes.
Yeah.
But if you've got a mortgage,
yeah.
you can just do a separate split on the mortgage for 30 grand
right,
and
yeah.
smash it over 4 years.
So it's not necessarily a car loan per se from the dealer. It's
yeah,
how
but
you...
a lot of car loans from dealers mm. will get a good, just as good as a house interest rate.
Is it? Well,
yeah,
obviously can... I don't do that, so
no,
I have no idea.
You can get really good finance from dealers.
Yeah, right.
If you own a property because they know there's meat and security there.
Or the alternative is that you figure out whatever that number was, the 700 per month, and you're like, well, that's if we're going to do it from the mortgage, then that's the amount that we've got to pay back in
and,
the mortgage.
And that's right. And you really have to be disciplined.
Yeah.
So for me, I pay cash for cars
because
it slows me down. It's painful.
Yeah. Great. Get in your own way with this stuff. Create
exactly.
barriers. Yeah.
Where in theory, it's better to get a car loan, invest that 30 grand and get a higher split than the interest rate.
Yeah. But next week you'll come in with a bloody Ferrari.
But that's the problem, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And that's, yeah. Because you want to just... So, and this is the problem with old mate with his $30,000 or whatever it is car.
Yeah.
He's thinking, we've got equity. I can get into my dream car and it's so cheap and we just push it out over 30 years. Now, you rinse and repeat that. You're just spending so much more money on a car.
Again and again and again. So let's say by the end of that 30 years, you've had four cars
yep.
or even two or three. You know, that's...
There's a lot of interest.
That's a lot
it's
of...
It's non-deductible.
For us, like, where are they now? They're probably in a scrap of
yep.
heap in a junkyard. Like, yeah.
So I'm really would encourage anyone, get a... If you are borrowing for a car, just have a look at the car yard interest rates if you're doing it through a dealer.
Yeah.
Because if you do own a home, the rates are pretty competitive.
I know that.
Yeah. Because it all goes back to, as you know, like, the car is security. So it's...
Mm.
And then they know if you own a home... There is meat in the background, so it's relatively low risk.
And come back to your goals. Like, mm. what is it that you really want a new car for mm. and at what cost? Because if it's meaning that you're not going to be able to be mortgage-free by the time you want, or you're going to have to work for longer, or you can't take the kids on that holiday you want to, is it really that important? How often do you drive it? Like, I don't know, aren't we all going to be driven around by robot cars in the future anyway? Like, I come back to the idea that I don't really care about cars so much and I forget people do. But I think from a financial perspective, I watched my mum's friend do this over and over and rinse and repeat and convince themselves that because there was growth and equity creation in the home, everything would be okay. And it's meant that they've had such long extensions of their mortgage.
Yeah. And I would recommend, even if you are borrowing against the mortgage, see if you can put 20% into the car, because that will kind of just sort out the depreciation. And then at any time, if you need to sell the car, because you've kind of prepaid that 20%, you've slowed down a bit because you've had to have some cash, the car will generally be worth what's left. That's just my loose rule of thumb.
Okay.
Putting 20% into it. So in this scenario, you've got to look at that number of what you can do, because you've got to just get this thing paid off.
And it's not just the initial car cost. I think that's the thing to think about, because if you've created quite a bit of equity or the property's grown a lot and you're like, it's only 30 grand. It's like, but it's not, or 40 grand or whatever we're arguing about it is. You know, look at the total interest number. As I said, I think ASIC's Money Smart website is fantastic. I think the home loan calculator, it can be really helpful if you're going to do a remortgage on the home loan to look at pre and post what the impact would be. But to your point, if you're going to go down the personal loan route using that personal loan calculator, it's free and it's easy and it's not super complicated. I think you and I have used to really complicated modeling stuff. You don't need to get that fancy. The numbers tell you your story.
And I would always say if you are buying a car with debt and you don't own a house, try and get a car loan because they'll use the car as security and it'll make the interest rate cheaper. Also, most of the time with car loans, they're a fixed loan for the period. So if you're paying it off earlier, you won't save interest because it's a fixed car loan for the time. And I wouldn't suggest that you'd want it over 4 years. Got to get that thing done and paid off.
Just maybe get a run around Peugeot like me.
Or do that. So we've used the compounding calculator, right, to work out, well, old mate's in the hole. If he keeps doing this, like $1,000 a week. Over the long term, that's the interest that is accruing and that they're paying, right? We have negative compounding returns. And I'm going to show everyone an example that will just blow your mind because it blows my mind.
When you start talking about negative returns. Yeah it is scary. So, fast too. Yeah.
So if you had $1,000, right, and that $1,000 grew by 100%, the account balance would be $2,000, okay? Simple maths. If you had $1,000 and you put it into an investment and that investment dropped to $500, a 50% loss, right? This is the thing that blows my mind. To get back to the $1,000, that $500 has to grow by 100%.
Exactly.
That is so wild.
And this is why it takes years often, and you should expect if you've had a period of volatility in your portfolio, it's not a fast fix. It can, because as you say, like we're working off a lower base number now, so the percentage increases are off that lower number. It takes years, and you should expect as an investor that there are A, going to be times of volatility, and B, that it's not a quick fix, that you're going to have to sit in the ride for as long as it possibly takes to get out.
I want to maybe just keep digging on this and talking about that whole crystallizing losses and gains.
Yeah, sure.
So if this was a live podcast and there was a question here, hey, Jess.
Yes.
You run Financially Fierce, the podcast.
I do.
How would you explain if I'm an investor and I want to crystallize my gains?
All losses.
All losses. Well, the effect of selling means you're crystallizing the loss if it's under. How would you explain this?
As a concept, I think it's not a hard one to get your head around, whether it be for a win or a loss, as you put it. We often talk about crystallizing loss. So I think it's important as an investor to remember that if you are not making a trade or selling out of something, what something is worth on the day is a paper trail more than anything else. And so really what we care about is what is something worth the day that we buy it and what is something worth the day that we sell it. Yes, there's other things to consider along the way in terms of growth and dividends and all the things, but what we often see, particularly during downturns, is people get fearful, they panic, and what they decide to do is they get this loss aversion. I don't want to lose any more money, so I'm going to sell out. And what we say is then you've crystallized that loss because up until that point, you haven't really lost anything, and the opportunity for it to come back and then some definitely still exists. But once you've pulled your card from that table and you've decided I'm out, you have absolutely crystallized that loss. And then do you know what normally happens, which is so frustrating? People then sit on the sidelines after they've sold at the lowest price because they're so fearful. They're sitting on the sidelines. And do you know when they go back in? When it's starting to do well again. So then they buy at a high time and they sell at a low time. I don't know. I feel like we got it the wrong way around.
But that's the emotional game of looking daily or weekly at your long-term investments.
And also not risk profiling your investments correctly. Because I think if you're going to invest in equity or the share market more broadly, you've got to really understand why am I investing there and how long am I investing for? Because if I've got a long-term game, maybe it's 10, 20, God, 30 years away, blips and volatility, A, is to be expected and B, isn't to be worried about. It's normal. It's when people take an enormous amount of risk, for example, oh, I want to buy a property next year. I'm going to chuck my whole deposit into the markets and just
YOLO it.
Yeah. Hope, pray to the gods of markets. And then they're like, oh my God, this has gone terribly. Now I'm not going to be able to get this apartment. God, I'm going to have to get the money out right now. They haven't taken the right level of risk for their goal. So I think you've got to be appropriate as well around what level of comfort do you have and understanding of share markets in terms of volatility? How long do you have until you need the money? General rule of thumb, I would say, is longer you've got to invest your money, the more risk and volatility that goal can handle. Similarly, if you've got a goal to like need cash for an apartment this year or next year, why would you chance it with the share market?
Mm. And that's it. Like I always say, if you don't need the money for over 4 years, it needs to go to work in some capacity.
Yep.
All that to say, if you're saving for something in the next 4 years, cash is good.
And if it's like 4 to 8 years, what are you saying? Balanced, medium,
yeah,
conservative?
Yeah, and this is an interesting discussion, right, about portfolio construction.
Yeah, and picking the right ETFs or managed funds or whatever and however you're doing it.
My, I guess, equity exposure is very, very just under 100% growth, right?
In total, your portfolio? Yeah. Right. Is that aligned to a very long-term goal?
Yes.
Okay.
And the long-term goal is I don't need the money now.
Great.
You can just go to work.
Yeah.
Now, if you look back, I'll make a scenario up. If I had $1 million in 100% growth, right, in equity portfolio.
Aussie, international mix.
Yep. Mm. Bit of property, all that stuff.
Yeah.
If I had an offset account over here or a bank account with 200 grand cash, if I look at my financial situation looking back, I don't have all my wealth in 100% growth because I've looked back.
Yeah.
But this is the psychology of it. We know that with portfolios that have an allocation to defensive, like the VDHG has a 10% allocation. Yeah. We had Chris Bricky from StockSpot on the other day. Their portfolios have a 15%, like their higher growth portfolios have like a 15%, 20% allocation to gold and defensive assets, because we know that over time, those portfolios do just as well as a 100% growth because the returns year on year, it smooths the returns out.
Yeah.
But I think this whole crystallizing share losses, it's an interesting point for two reasons. The first one is the paper gain and paper loss, which means, everyone, you haven't actually sold. So I bought $1,000 worth of shares in, you know, a startup, dropped to $500. Now, that's a paper loss.
Because you haven't made any change.
We haven't done a trade.
Yep, yep.
But the minute I click, oh my gosh, I'm freaking out, and click sell, that has created a physical tax event.
Yep.
Which that's, you know, because the crystallizing is like when water or like gel gets a bit crystally.
Who makes these stupid things that we use? I think about it like honey.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
You get that smooth honey and then it gets a bit.
Because I like it because I think bees are like little assets that go to work for us and they've all got a job and it's part of this bigger hive. I like sort of thinking
about the queen.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or king or whatever.
No, it's the queen bee.
I know, I know, but I was trying to be inclusive. But yes.
No, don't. Queen bee, she rocks. So it's that whole crystallizing thing, and it goes back to the behavior of I understand that if I physically click sell, it creates a tax event. Mm-hmm. Even if I buy the next day and it takes off again.
Yeah.
Because it's just terrible.
And research, and I could be getting this wrong, but research basically says when it bottoms out, and look, we never know the bottom until it rises again. So you never know how low something is going to go. Statistically speaking, you know, we've been talking about this negative return and how hard it is to come back. When you look at a bottom out, typically really high levels of growth are within a very short period in terms of days after that bottoming. And normally that's when people haven't got the courage yet to get back in the markets if they've pulled themselves out. You know, if you look at the graphs around the GFC, you know, when people were overexposed in growth assets, probably not understanding what they were invested in, perhaps coming really close to retirement age, et cetera. Like behavioral finance fascinates me. If you look at it pragmatically, you buy low and sell high. The challenge is we don't know what low is or when high is either. And so coming back to really simple fundamentals around dollar cost averaging and getting out of your own way and not checking every day because you're not a day trader, that's not what long-term passive income creation's for. And yet understanding that negative returns, I don't think get enough airtime in terms of how, you know, the growth thereafter needs to be pretty considerable. And what that practically means is you got to be patient.
And I reckon, you know how they say past performance isn't an indication of future performance? I think it is when you step back and look at growth markets over a long enough period. So you look at the index, S&P 200 or the S&P 500, the past performance is every time the market shats itself, it recovers.
Listen, it's the best we've got.
Yeah. So, in effect, past performance is a good indication of the future.
It's just not a guarantee.
But it's not a guarantee. But I would almost guarantee, because it's really philosophical, I would almost guarantee over a 10-year period, share markets will be more than what they are. However, if they totally crap themselves, mm-hmm. there's probably bigger problems because your house is worth nothing. Mm. You've got to get a petrol generator.
AI has taken over your job. So
there's zombies walking around. Mm. So all that to say, this crystallizing losses, if the markets, you know, as we're recording this on the 11th of April, which is a Wednesday, is it? No, it's a Thursday. This is going up next Tuesday, the 16th. This week, the markets have come off a bit in the States and in Australia.
The last few months have been
really good.
Yeah.
No one talks about, the markets have been really good lately. Mm. Like, we get this attention when it has come off. Mm. And guess what? Markets go in cycles. Mm. And some weeks and some months are down because there's sell-offs and profit-taking and inflation data and, you know, interest rates out of America. Like, things, economic cycles are exactly that. They're cycles.
And good news doesn't sell as well as bad news does. And that gets so much more airtime. And we as humans, we are smart. Fear is for safety. And so fear is a really clever mechanism for our body to stay alive. Yep. It's just really annoying when you overlay it with money, because fear drives decisions that erode years, sometimes decades worth of wealth creation. But it's ultimately coming from this psychological, you know, quest for safety. And our job in at that moment is to actually put on the brakes and go, hey, my brain's being really smart here, evolutionarily designed to keep me as safe and as alive as I can be. But I can't let fear make this irrational, illogical, moment-based decision. I've got to step way back, or I've got to have an agreement with three friends that I talk to before I am allowed to sell anything. And our job is to make sure that we're actually really thoughtful in that sell, because we want to sell when we want to, not because we have to. And fear is a major driver in that.
In my early 20s, I had a savings account with another bank that had a PIN number. I gave a savings buddy half of the PIN code. So if I wanted to go to the account, like, hey, I need to access this money, they're like, oh, yeah, what for? I'm like, I don't know, want to buy something. Oh, no, you told me that this was for future Glenn and buying this car. No, so there's that friction there.
Did it work? And did you remain friends?
Yes.
See, this is so good, because we've got to put automations in play to get out of our own way to build a financial system that works, but we've also got to put barriers in place to stop us from self-sabotaging.
And I would say, like, if you're really on the edge of like, oh, should I spend this money on this? Put a poll up in the Facebook group. They'll tell you if it's dumb or not.
With kindness.
With kindness.
Course. It's a nice community.
So Liz, in answer to your question, does anyone know if there is a calculator that shows bad compounding interest? Liz, there's calculators that show compounding interest. Now, if you borrow money and you have to pay interest on it, it inverts the same way as a growth compound interest calculator. So the only thing that's bad about it is it's non-deductible and it's attached to an asset that is going down in value.
A liability.
Yeah.
Big chat on that one.
Yeah. So that was the first question, guys. We'll take a break and we'll come back right after this.
If you're after personal financial advice, don't get it from a podcast. If you would like help based on your own personal situation, head over to sortyourmoneyout.com. Click Get Help and we'd be happy to introduce you to one of our trusted advisors. Our panel of advisors, mortgage brokers and accountants work with clients all over Australia so they can connect with you wherever you are. That's sortyourmoneyout.com and click Get Help.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Okay, now it is time for the community segment of the week, where we ask you in the Facebook group a heap of different questions and we read them out here on the podcast. This segment is brought to you by Sky Wealth. I'm a big believer that you need to protect the most important thing in your life, and that is your ability to earn, or if you were to die, there is protection in place for your family. You can reach out to sky.com.au or just search Sky Wealth and have a chat to them today about getting your income protection sorted and your whole suite of insurances. Okay, we asked you what your guilty pleasure spending habit that you just can't quit. Oh my gosh, I can't wait to read these.
Oh my goodness.
Before we get into that, do you have any personally?
My guilty spending habit
that you can't quit.
I spend a lot of money on skincare. I could quit it though. Mm. I'm trying to figure out if it's like.
But that's your thing.
I want it to be my thing because we're getting old, Glenn, and I've just decided that I need to care about it. But it is my guilty pleasure. I try very hard not to look at how much the total is because it sends me into a spiral, but I still do it. So I guess that is a guilty pleasure of sorts. Yep. And I get these really expensive facial now, as you can probably tell.
Sure.
I'm going to say that's my guilty pleasure.
I think mine is, so like I usually roll like a number one head shave, right? Yeah. And I go to the barber for them to do that.
Okay.
Because I just hate doing it myself.
Could you do it yourself?
Yeah. And this is why what I've done was I'm like, oh, I can. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to go. I bought a really expensive electric shaver that I can plug into the wall.
Yeah.
Got a little extension lead. I got a sticker mirror that I stuck in my shower so I can stand in there, not with it running, just so I can shave my head myself.
Yeah.
And then I can just sweep it up from, anyway. So that was like, I think $200, right? I'm like, I just need to use this four times and it'll pay for itself because most barber visits are $50.
Okay.
So that's been paid for now, but I still like to go to the barber because I actually hate doing it myself and it's really hard to get my beard in line. So that's my guilty pleasure. Everyone's like, why don't you just do it yourself? Like, one, I don't want to, and two, it's just so much easier sometimes to go in and get someone to do it.
I think on that sort of vein, I have a weekly cleaner because I hate laundry. I have some sort of strange aversion to laundry.
A cleaner or a housekeeper?
Well, I think she's a clean. I don't know. I've had her for so many years.
No, but does she do your laundry?
She does everything. She sweeps out the back for me
right.
in my courtyard.
Yep.
She changes the bedding on my beds.
Yeah, so that's getting into housekeeper, I think.
Oh, she comes every week.
Mm-hmm.
And basically my job through the week is to wash as many things as I can and to just create some sort of washing doom pile, which I do quite successfully. And then she has to sort it out, poor love, and then put it all away. And that is something that I'm so happy to pay for because for some reason my brain – I hate laundry. I hate laundry. I'll vacuum, wash up, I'll do everything.
Yeah, I mean, everyone does, but it is more that you have taken the view that I value spending that and I don't value spending more than $2,000 on a car.
Correct. Because the mental health reprieve it gives me to have her come for 3 hours a week is worth so much more than the outlay.
Yep, that's awesome. Kirsten said all the books, so.
Oh, I resonate deeply with that. Di said, this is so good, marinated goat's cheese. Marinated goat's cheese is really good and can be quite expensive, so I get it.
Hayley said, a little treaty treat at the petrol station.
Where you pay double and then but you feel so good about it. I know.
What's your little petrol station treat?
Do you know what I love? And I do it at the airport as well. I like a summer roll or like a nougat honey. I love them.
Yep. Holly said, I have this guilty pleasure of buying avocados and bananas to watch them go brown.
Oh, God. Ben says, I wouldn't say it's a pleasure, but I feel guilty. Shopping bags because I always forget to bring my reusable ones. Oh,
sometimes as a strategy, I'll go to Woolworths without bags when I need more paper ones for home.
No, he's talking about like the green ones, the reusable ones.
Right. Yes, that's right. But I've got my millennial money tote bags, and actually I'll get some This Is Money tote bags.
Oh, great.
I got them in the car.
Yeah.
But sometimes if I need paper bags for home just to have, if someone comes over there, I'm like, oh, do you want this? Yeah. Anyway, irrelevant. Michael, my dogs, I spend too much on them, from toys to treats to clothes. You've just done an episode on the costs of pets on Financially Fierce podcast.
I agree with that.
What did Aleski say?
Alexi, I hope I'm saying that right.
Aleski, yeah.
Alcohol. Tried to quit so many times but just keep coming back. Currently limiting myself to Fridays and Saturdays only to keep spending and health in check.
Toby, my partner and I love going to a fancy restaurant once a month. We're talking $250 plus every time we go. We just can't shake the delicious food. And that's awesome. It's a couple's goal. We value this. We hit the quality time, we hit the experience, we hit the food. And as long as it's not done with debt, what's the problem?
Yeah, and they've obviously planned for it because it's a monthly thing by the sound of it.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Ruhi says, I said it at the Melbourne event on stage and I'll say it again. Glenn James, he's tagged you. Pleasures shouldn't be guilty. If it brings you healthy joy, embrace it. And cute little emojis afterwards.
I think pleasures become guilty when they overtake.
But do you reckon they actually feel better because there's guilty, like this little, like almost element of naughtiness?
Yeah, I'm a bit naughty. I shouldn't be doing this.
Or are we just children?
We're that as well. Okay, let's go into some quick housekeeping. One of the things I'm continuing to talk about is the Financially Fierce podcast. Just what is the podcast about and what are you doing with it?
Yeah, so Glenn asked me to start a podcast where I talk about everything that I want to about money, which is really exciting. My job, I think, as someone who is pretty passionate about this, is to help people feel more confident and bold in their decisions. You know, it's why we called it Financially Fierce. I want to dive deep into everything from behavioral sort of components to money to how to practically set yourself up and different strategies. And so, yeah, the idea is every week I tackle something different and give my thoughts to help people be better with money.
You can subscribe to Financially Fierce right now in your player. Give us a little review if you're liking the show. And finally, if you've got parents or grandparents over age 50 or 55, make sure you send them to the Retire Right podcast. The big focus this year for us is the Financially Fierce podcast and Retire Right. There's a broader thing happening with me in the business where I just want to diversify from me as much as possible. And that's why we're having good quality shows that are not named within the This Is network. And there's an episode coming up soon on a bonus Saturday where I give some business goals and stuff for people. So watch out for that one. Rightio, let's get back into the show. Kim asked, if you were 24 years old and just had started working FIFO, where would you invest your money? What are you saying to Kim?
Don't buy crap. We grew up in the same area. I finished school as the mining boom was booming, and I had lots of friends who I went to school with who were probably 24 earning hundreds of thousands of dollars. And what that translated to was big cars, jet skis.
Yeah, baby.
All the fancy things. Because of course, you know, they were given this enormous amount of income and no formal money training or education. So they just bought all the things. So what I would say to you is, Kim, awesome.
It's for her daughter, actually. She's writing on behalf of her daughter.
Oh.
There was other comments there, yeah.
Oh, right. I didn't see the comments. I think, you know, you're 24. You are sacrificing a lot to work in a FIFO job. And often what we can translate that to, you know, I worked in an investment bank, which was a very notorious investment bank for having worked their staff very hard. And so what you sometimes convince yourself is, I'm allowed to do this. I deserve to spend this because I work so hard. And we justify all these big, crazy purchases because you're trading off your time or you're, you know, away from loved ones. I think someone who's 24 earning really good coin has this amazing opportunity to figure out, like, what are your big dreams and how can you accelerate them? So I can't tell you what to invest in because I don't know what you want to do, but getting really clear. And 24 is not 18. I think you've had a couple of years longer to mature and to grow up and to see some things. I always think that traveling for young people is one of the most important, rewarding, richening experiences that you can ever spend money on. But I think it helps you kind of get used to interesting situations and understand yourself a lot better. So I would definitely tell all young people, if they can afford it, to go and have a trip solo, preferably, just to go and test yourself. But then I think come back and figure out, like, what are your goals? And then that should drive what you're doing. But I think having a solid cash flow plan, very important.
Yeah, I actually said to Kim, and I will be doing it this week, sending her a copy of our book, Sort Your Money Out and Sort Your Career Out. Because in this situation, what I kind of alluded it to at the top of the episode, do you see yourself FIFOing in 10 years, in 5 years? If their answer is no, we need to have a plan in place. Yep. And that's going to be our career.
Or to bank lots and lots of cash if you can.
That's right. And so in that vein, it is like, okay, in the real world, I might only be earning 80 grand as opposed to $191,000 FIFOing, right? Mm. So can you adjust your budget and what you live off based on a more real world salary of what you want to go into in the future? And then it's a matter of, okay, we need to, it's like the professional sports player. I've got 5, 10 years on the field, yeah, max at this good money. This is not real life. Now, the thing is, if Kim's daughter is happy to FIFO and in the future she wants to find a partner or start a family, we're not saying FIFO is not possible, because there's a lot of FIFO workers. Think of airline pilots and cabin crew. They're basically FIFO. They're away from home at, you know, various times. So it's not impossible, but I think it's just working about, in the future, is this something that I can see myself doing?
Yeah, and like I had a partner years ago who worked in a mine. Like, it can be pretty hardcore. They can do like 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off or whatever. So yeah, I think it comes back to like, what do you want to do with your life and how do you set it up that way? I know for some of them as well, like they're put into remote areas where, yep, they don't have any living costs because they don't, they live on site and they get fed and whatever. I think it's about, particularly if you're young and all of your friends around you are maybe not earning as much as you, don't get tempted into thinking, oh, well, I want to shout them everything and I want to be this overly generous person at the expense of my goals. Because if this is only for a couple of years to really expedite your, you know, wealth position, for God's sake, use it and don't waste it.
I mean, if in doubt, Kim's daughter, what I would say to you is, until you've really distilled your goals and your own eat, pray, love vibe of your life, it's okay just to build up cash. That's totally fine. But we don't want to sit there potentially with a pile of cash for over 4 years, but it's okay while you work things out. It's like, do you want to buy a property? Do you want to invest? And if you, and this is where it comes to, I think I'll be done here within 5 years, but I'm not 100% sure. Yes, I've got lots of excess money that I don't need at the moment. It's totally okay to say I'm going to live off an equivalent of $70,000 or $80,000.
Yep.
I'm going to have a real strict, as you said, budget and spending plan.
Mm-hmm.
What's left over, I'm putting 50% into a savings account, out of sight, out of mind, and the other 50% in a blended ETF portfolio. Just hedge that bet.
Yeah, or like a tiny little portion into super if you've got under your caps, because you're, yep, 24, you won't even notice it gone.
Yep.
And 60-something-year-old you is going to be so damn proud because you're so young to be doing that.
Yep.
I agree with you. I think that sort of combo is typically quite good, and then it gives some flexibility in terms of having cash available, but you've already got, you've also got stuff working for you.
This is coming from, you know, two recovering financial advisors. The question isn't where do I invest my money? It's what does your life look like and what do you want to do?
Yeah, and that should form the strategy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
And we can't answer that for her, no, so therefore we don't know.
But I think 24 years old, I'd be thinking, do a smash and grab for the next 5 years, get that money, bank it, because one day, and this is another thing, there's another thing that people would freak out about, and I'm going to go there, Jess.
Off you go.
What if you saved, and I'll call it 100 grand in cash, once you've done your FIFO, you're like, I really want to be a speech therapist. And go to uni and work part-time and use some of that cash to fund your life while you retrain. So use it as a dry powder to retrain and reskill and all that as an option.
Or if you like what some, you know, we're just talking about athletes, if you are on that schedule where it's like 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, you know, think about whether that's something you can do part-time as well, so that that 100K, I don't know, is then maybe used to help you buy your first investment property if that's important to you or whatever. So I think you've got so many great options. Don't waste it. Don't blow it. Don't buy all the things. Like if you want a boat, hire one for the weekend. If you want a jet ski, hire one when you need one. You don't need one sitting in the bloody front yard. And be really clear, because you're giving up your life to go probably somewhere pretty remote, to give up the opportunity to socialize with your friends or be part of a, I don't know, footy team or whatever it is. You are making sacrifices, often quite big ones, sometimes invisible ones. Don't waste the reward of that sacrifice, which is the money.
Mm-hmm.
And you could set yourself up so well here.
Yeah. And if you totally do not have any self-control, just commit to, I'm just investing this in super, done. Or I will go and buy a property and commit to it. Like,
yeah,
it goes back to the personality. But all this is this, whether it's FIFO or you're a professional athlete or footy player, there's a lot of professional sports people that have paid full time to run around and chase a ball or whatever, which is good income. Mm. This is no different. You've got a window of time. Not all footy players, not all soccer players, not all netball players end up as the commentator with the contract at Fox Sports or whatever.
Yeah.
There's a chance that that's not going to happen.
Yeah. And you should expect that.
Yep. So you need to really plan, what do you want to do when you grow up? A friend of mine had dinner with him the other night. He's been on the show before. He was a professional ballet dancer for the Australian Ballet. Recently decided he wanted to stop that mm-hmm. and do something else. Mm. Awesome. Mm. So there is a time where you will make a change.
And you should make hay while the sun shines.
There's a question here from Bridget.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to read that one?
Yes. Bridget says, wondering if anyone has merged their super fund with their partner to minimize fees and reap high returns, etc. I'm not even too sure if you can do this, but wanting to know people's experiences. Thanks.
Mm. What do you take from that one?
Yeah, so merging super funds, I think that I don't know if that's exactly what she's talking about. Presumably she's talking about maybe even setting up a self-managed super fund,
yeah,
which I don't
want
to get too complex.
Yeah. I've got an episode coming up, everyone, dedicated to self-managed super funds.
Yeah, right. I don't think you can do this with industry funds, but I know some of the funds that are used by financial advisors. Yes, there is a way where you effectively keep your own super fund, but you're under almost an umbrella, a family umbrella. And so what will happen is the fee tiering. So normally the higher your balance, the lower the fee, and it goes through like a tiering system. It can be aggregated based on the family's account. So if one of you has 100,000 and one of you's got 400,000 in super, then the total fee will be based off the family balance, which is 500, which might be over a threshold, which is cheaper. So you're not actually merging your super accounts. You've got two distinctly different super fund numbers. But the tiering and the fee aggregation can happen in a family account. I just don't think you can do that in an industry fund situation.
No.
Yet, maybe.
So, yeah, I would probably say, and we will continue it with the self-managed super fund dedicated episode, but you really want to have, I think, a combined balance of well over 250 grand before you even worry about a self-managed super fund.
I also think you need to have the inclination and care to manage it
because
it's self-managed.
That's right. And, you know, if you had a $250,000 super fund balance and the annual accounting fee, and I'm just using an example, I paid mine a couple of weeks ago, full disclosure, I've got a self-managed super fund. My annual accounting or audit, like accounting slash audit fee was $1,800, which is a pretty good price. There's probably a lot of people paying more
double
than
that. Yeah.
That's 0.72%. of a $250,000 balance. So that adds up as a big admin fee where you could just put that money in your run-of-the-mill retail fund or even funds with financial advisors can be around this price anyway. Like, it's wild.
Just to confirm and explain, you're also paying an investment fee.
That's right. So on top of that, you've probably got to pay 0.3.
Yeah.
So you're at 1% before you even wake up of the morning.
Yeah.
All the paperwork, all the
compliance
drama,
risk.
The risk you carry as a trustee.
Yeah.
So it's not for everyone. So
and 250, I think, is still low.
Yeah.
And why would you do it? Right. Unless you want to buy real property.
Yeah. There are other reasons you would, If you were a hardcore cryptite and you were just like, I want to put all my super in crypto, you might do it that way. I had a client once, we set up a super fund because he wanted to buy shares in a listed company that he worked for that was outside of the top 300, and he's like the super fund trustee that he was with wouldn't allow it. So we did like, so there are reasons, but again, it goes back to, for most people, most of the time, you don't need a self-managed super fund.
No. So look at fee aggregation sort of super funds, and presumably you're seeing a financial advisor to find access to one of those. I don't know if any of them have like a retail direct-to-consumer arm.
There's a question here from Nicole. We might finish up with this one because I've got to go to a meeting. Need a sounding board. I invest a small percentage into a clean energy ETF. I'm passionate about investing in this space. One particular ETF is doing poorly. I don't want to sell, but I'm considering not putting more in. Kind of leading back to this crystallizing discussion at the top. I'm torn. On the one hand, shares are quote unquote on sale, but on the other, it's been trending down for 12 months and I think I've given it a decent chance. Would you continue to put small money in? Eventually, I think it will improve because of global trends towards renewables, etc. Or pause adding in new money to see if it will bounce. Not trying to time the market, just trying to minimize a potential loss. Awesome. So I asked like what ETF and what allocation. She's in the CLNE ticker. It's the VanEck Global Clean Energy ETF, and it's a 10% allocation. What would you do in this sitch if you had a portfolio with a 10% satellite that was that it's dogged out a little bit?
Yeah, and I think to the point that she made earlier, like this is something that's quite important to her in terms of her the passion and getting that sort of value alignment. And from a thematic perspective, she's got conviction in what is going to happen in the world. So when you're talking about sort of themed-based ETFs or thematic investing, she believes or has taken a position that clean energy as a sector or as a market is going to continue to rise and grow. And so, again, we come back to, you know, when you're setting your investment strategy, you're taking a position. And so philosophically, there's a value alignment piece and obviously a piece that you believe that this sector is growing. I think when times are down, it can be really easy to second guess yourself. But unless something new has come to light around why you don't have a conviction in it anymore, I think you're just feeling what everyone feels when markets are going down. What I did look at was there's a couple of ETFs that are, well, I would say, like pretty dark green in terms of ethical sort of screening, which I've used before for clients. And, you know, I looked at the five-year average performance of the global ethical fund and it's done really well, significantly outperformed the index. And then I looked at the Aussie component of that, or the Aussie ETF that's pretty dark green, and it's below the index. And so, again, we come back to, and I would imagine that that's because the last few years banks have done so well. And I believe that this particular ETF doesn't really have a big holding into the majors. And so, you know, this is why we talk about diversification. It's why most people are doing index-based philosophies. It's why you have it as a satellite, because it's not the core component of your portfolio. You've taken a position. And I think you've got to ask yourself, do you still believe that this sector is going to grow, or has something fundamentally changed that means that the game has changed? Because that then becomes a different conversation. But if you just think it's a lull and that this is where the future is going, we're just in a potential down phase. I don't know enough about the fees and performance of that particular ETF. Don't panic would be my comment.
Yeah, and my comment is, you know, the reason you went into this was because you believed in the underlying investments, because
and the philosophy, I guess.
And the philosophy, because, you know, the VanEck CLNE, VanEck Global Clean Energy ETF, there's 30 holdings in it. So you can use this conversation with insert thematic ETF here, right? I know the, I think the Global X Robotics and their one, like, it's done really well. AI and robotics, and I think
there's cyber ones, there's food ones, there's gold
so
ones.
It really doesn't matter what it is, but the question you need to ask yourself is, why did you go? So what I would say to Nicole is, if before she invested in this, and let's do a role play. All right, hi Nicole.
Hello.
And you actually, we'll do the role play, but you ask me about this.
Well, I don't know, because I don't know where you want to go with
this. Oh yeah, okay. Well, ask me like, should I invest in this thematic CLNE thing? Okay.
Okay.
Ask me that. Go on.
Are you Nicole?
No, you are.
So like. Oh, okay. Hi, Glenn. You're an expert.
Not really, but I'll talk with absolute confidence and pretend I am.
Great. Should I invest in this ETF that's all around clean energy?
Okay. So why do you want to do that?
because I'm passionate about investing in this space.
Okay.
And I think because of global trends towards renewable energy, it makes sense. I'm just copying her words from
No, that's great. And, you know, how much do you think you'll be allocating out of your entire portfolio into this ETF?
Look, I don't think I should put a lot in because I'm still learning, and but I do, as I said, have a particular interest. So I was thinking, I don't know, like 10%.
Yeah, okay, cool. And I'll assume, Nicole, that your core holding is a broad-based ETF. To say yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. So, Nicole, a question. You know, we know that themes and satellites in portfolios, you know, you're not putting 100% of your money into this. Mm. So we know that there could be some volatility.
Mm-hmm.
And like if I said to you, Nicole, like, oh, would you be happy if this decreased over the short term? Because you want to hold it for the long term, right? You're a long-term investor, Nicole.
Yeah.
So if you're holding this for the next 10 years, Nicole, you wouldn't care too much if it dropped 25% in the first few years, would you?
I mean, you're right. Like I do want it for the long term, and I guess I would just need to expect that that's a possibility.
Yeah. So we'll end the role play there because it was pretty bad. But a lot of the time, you kind of answered it right. Before you put your real money in, a lot of the time you say to someone, oh, there can be chances of negative returns. Like, I get that. But when it actually happens, then you freak out.
Mm.
So I'm just looking. You've just got to, with these themes at the ETFs, go and look at the underlying holdings. So there's a lot of solar stuff here. You know, all these companies I've never heard of. The maximum exposure is to Nextracker Incorporated. At just under 6% exposure. And I'm looking at the Nextracker share price. It's an American listing. Yeah, it's had a run. The first of this year, it's had a decent size run.
Which means the share price has performed well.
Yes, yeah. Yep. But that individual company has come off.
And that's been 6% of the total portfolio, which is 10% of her total portfolio.
Yeah, so look, the whole sector, it could be a trend that will increase in the future, as she says, but it's about having the stomach to understand that these, and this is, gosh, how long is a piece of string? Like, there's going to be more volatility with these ETFs because the underlying companies are going to have more volatility because you don't get your big CBA size, big
mature, established,
mass caps. What do they call them? Big caps, whatever.
Mac caps.
What do they call it?
No, that's the Macquarie
large
division.
Large caps.
Small cap and large cap. We're having a moment.
Yeah, you generally don't get your big stable slugs that it's the size of your CBAs, your Woolworths and all that are investing in solar only.
But also, similarly, you've often got more speculative ones, and some do really well and are the next big thing, and some fizzle out and don't go anywhere, and that's the risk.
So what I would say, back to her question, would you continue to put small money in or pause adding new? I'm not selling, probably.
And she's not suggesting selling either. No.
Well, it could just be a lesson of you've had a lesson in negative returns.
Mm.
I would go back to what do you want your long-term portfolio to be? And actually, everyone, in the book that's just gone to typesetting, the Quick Start Guide to Investing, in the back of it, this is actually really cool. I did this, and I've been talking about it for ages, but I did a personal investing constitution. So you can go down and write down, this is my financial goals. This is how I'm going to do that. At all times, I'm not having more than 10% in specky stuff at all times. So you need to go back to your Rosetta Stone.
Yeah, I get my members to do something similar.
Yeah. And it's like, so when these things come up and it's come off, no, we go back to our constitution that we wrote when we were in a good frame of mind and with our strategy and we weren't worried with fluctuations, and we go, yes, this is what I agreed on. Okay, so at the moment, it's worth 5% of my portfolio because it's come off. Well, my constitution says I rebalance and I want 10% in that at all times. So are you putting more money into it to get it up to the 10%?
Mm.
And this is, yeah, it's a wild time.
And 12 months in the scheme of investing is not very long for a downturn. It's just a lot of new investors saw the COVID blip, which was what, weeks, months at best. It can last a long time. And so, you know, I would argue 12 months is not a huge.
So take that with what you will.
I feel like sometimes we create more questions than answers. Mm.
But the ETF itself, like it's...
I don't know anything about this ETF.
No, neither do I. I'm just looking at it now. I think it's 0.3... yeah, so it's 0.65. So it's not a cheap ETF.
Yeah.
But to get that exposure to your theme, you'll pay for that. And it's tracking the SME Global Energy Select Index. So all index funds aren't cheap, just usually when there's more is more, which can mean less fees because of the scale and
inflows, yeah,
and all that stuff.
It's an exciting space, though, in terms of the new sort of ethical and green options that are coming out. And to your point, like we've seen already, some of the ETF providers have reduced their fees on some of their ethical ETFs, and that's an exciting space as more and more people start to think about it. Just come back to the fundamentals of why you're investing, what's the goal, and what are you going to say to yourself when markets are down?
Absolutely. Hey, I've got to bounce, but Jess Brady from Financially Fierce Podcast, thank you so much for joining us on This Is Monet.
Thank you always for having me. I can't believe that you let me come back despite every time being often a disaster with me. So thanks, Glenn and team, for having me.
We arrived. Okay, thanks, friends. Bye.
We acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which we live and work and pay respects to their elders past, present and emerging. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who may listen to this podcast. If you are interested in furthering your education around money, your career or property, we have three books that might help. Check out Sort Your Money Out, Sort Your Career Out and Sort Your Property Out. Find these wherever good books are sold or via the link in the podcast show notes. This podcast is for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general financial advice only, which does not take into account your objectives, financial situation, or needs. Because of that, you should consider if the advice is appropriate to you and your needs before acting on the information. If you do choose to buy a financial product, read the product disclosure statement, target market determination, and obtain appropriate financial advice tailored to your needs. SIMO Interactive Proprietary Limited, the publisher of the podcast, and Glenn James are authorised representatives of Money Sherpa Proprietary Limited, which holds financial services license 451289.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.